Chapter 3, Going for Refuge. In the Pali scriptures, we read of many people coming to see the Buddha. He gives them a short teaching, which so impresses them, so changes them, that they are impelled to reorient their entire lives as a result. Quote, "It's as if something that had fallen over was put upright again. Things that were obscure are now quite clear," end quote, they say. Quote, "It's like light being brought into a dark room. I was completely lost and you've shown me the way. I go for refuge to you, to your Dharma and your Sangha. May I be one of your disciples for as long as I live," end quote. The practice of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha is one of the most ancient in all of Buddhism, but the notion of going for refuge can sit uncomfortably with some of our present day ideas. The idea that we might need a refuge can seem a bit escapist, even weak. We don't like to think of ourselves as being unable to face up to life, of needing to take shelter from reality. But we deceive ourselves. The truth is that the very large majority of us are escapist. We hardly ever face up to the facts of life, and we take refuge from them in one way or another all the time. The trouble is that we go for refuge to things that are not true refuges. Quote, "Many people, out of fear, flee for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees and shrines. In reality, this is not a safe refuge. In reality, this is not the best refuge. Fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from all suffering. He who goes for refuge to the Enlightened One, to the Truth, and to the spiritual community, who sees with perfect wisdom the four Aryan truths, namely, suffering, the origin of suffering, the passing beyond suffering, and the Aryan eight-membered way leading to the pacification of suffering. For him, this is a safe refuge. For him, this is the best refuge. Having gone to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering." End quote. These days we may not, as in the time of the Dharmapada, flee for refuge to sacred hills, groves, trees and shrines. Instead we dream of winning the lottery, finding the perfect partner, having the perfect holiday, being anywhere in fact, rather than here and now, facing up to the truth of things. Unwilling to face up to the Buddha's first noble truth, that all conditioned things are intrinsically unsatisfactory, we conjure up visions and dreams as a refuge from our sense of inner incompleteness. Our multiple strategies for avoiding facing up to the way things really are, however, inevitably come to nothing. Reality, inexorably, reasserts itself through all our vain efforts to deny it, and so we suffer. We may think that having the perfect partner will end our suffering forever, but there are no perfect people out there. Our friends and partners, being human and unenlightened, will inevitably let us down, and in any case, like everyone else, they will one day die. There are no perfect partners, perfect friends, perfect jobs, perfect families, perfect holidays, or perfect meals. Despite everything the advertising industry tries to tell us, there are no perfect chocolate bars or ice creams either. And yet, like hamsters on a wheel, we pass our time energetically scurrying about in quest of that perfect X factor, which will put a stop finally and forever to our inner sense of unsatisfactoriness, our own incompleteness. Instead of taking refuge in dreams of wealth and power, or in the fleeting pleasures of chocolate bars, shopping and television, we need to face the truth head on. Instead of taking refuge in delusion, we need to take refuge in the truth. In order to do this, however, we need to reverse a deep-seated process. I want this, I don't want that, I like this, I don't like that. Responding in this way to the constantly changing circumstances of life, we build and rebuild ourselves as more or less stable ego identities, struggling to maintain their boundaries within the swirling tide of conditions. What we pull inside those boundaries, the food we like, the people we associate with, the things we watch and read, and what we push out, the people we don't want to be with, the clothes we won't wear, the places we avoid, all these define the shape and contours of our ego identity. And this process runs on and on from minute to minute. We are constantly hard at work, defining and redefining ourselves to ourselves and to the world, vainly struggling to get hold of that elusive X factor that will give us some sense of peace and stability in the face of constant change. As long as we remain in denial of the facts of life, however, this process is doomed. All conditioned things are impermanent, insubstantial, and ultimately unsatisfactory. So taught the Buddha, and until we face up to this and deal with life as it really is, we will suffer. Previously, we took in distractions in one form or another and pushed out the painful truths of impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. Instead, we need to take in the truth and push out delusion. Going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, we open ourselves to the highest truth, to the way in which that truth may be discovered, and to all those men and women throughout history who have made that truth their own and are able to impart it. Going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is the exact opposite of escapism. Living escapist lives, we use all kinds of strategies to avoid facing up to the deepest truth of things. We bury ourselves under our duvets or engage energetically with the world in order to amass wealth. We even escape into good works and humanitarian activity. But only by finally facing up to the true nature of things with every aspect of our being will we ever find any real peace and happiness. And only when we are deeply rooted in the truth will we be really effective in helping others. The Buddha saw all this perfectly clearly, and everything he said and did was an expression of that fact. Communication with him must have been electrifying. It cut straight through people's cherished delusions. Yet they responded wholeheartedly. It was as if light was brought into darkness. What they had always sought was suddenly right there before them, and right away they committed themselves to putting it into practice. We ourselves may not have had the good fortune to meet a Buddha face to face, but many people have such a response when they first hear the Dharma. For many of us, it's an experience of coming home, of hearing what we had known deep in our hearts, but which we had never before been able to articulate. So we go for refuge to it. The change that takes place at this point is spoken of in Pali as the shift from Karmachanda to Dharmachanda. Karmachanda is the thirst for sense experience. Dharmachanda is the thirst for the truth, or the wholesome. Previously, we lived entirely under the sway of Karmachanda, the endless quest for distracting sense experience, the thirst for those sense experiences that give us an apparently stable sense of ourselves. Now we try increasingly to orient our lives towards the active pursuit of the truth. In the case of some very rare individuals, this reorientation happens fully and almost instantaneously. In the Buddha's lifetime, that seems to have happened to many of the people he met. After hearing what he had to say, many of them gained profound insights, which changed them forever. For most of us today, it is a change which has slow beginnings and takes place by degrees. We gradually reorientate our lives so that they are increasingly informed by the values of the three jewels, and for the large majority of us, the process of going for refuge to the three jewels involves a constant effort to reorientate our being away from the thirst for sense experience towards the thirst for the Dharma. That effort is the very essence of the Buddhist spiritual life, and all Buddhist teachings and practices in one way or another have this as their object and focus. Sangharakshita has made many important contributions to the understanding of the Dharma today, but perhaps the most important of these is his insight that the act of going for refuge to the three jewels is the principal Buddhist practice. Going for refuge is primary, it is what makes one a Buddhist, and therefore something that all Buddhists have in common. The way in which that going for refuge is expressed, whether as a monk, householder, wanderer, or non-celibate full-timer, is secondary. As well as this, Sangharakshita has seen that going for refuge deepens by degrees, and he has described different levels of going for refuge. For example, there are the cultural, provisional, effective, real, and absolute levels. Cultural going for refuge is the level of those people who think of themselves as being Buddhists because they were born into a Buddhist family or Buddhist culture, although they have no commitment to spiritual practice. The provisional level of going for refuge is the level of all those who consciously begin to lead a Buddhist spiritual life, but are not yet fully committed to it. At the effective level, one's commitment to the three jewels is the central axis of one's life to the extent that one's living conditions allow. Real going for refuge arises in dependence upon the arising of transcendental insight. After that has happened, one can no longer completely fall back under the sway of delusion. Absolute going for refuge is equivalent to Buddhahood. Within all this, there is one particular stage that different Buddhist schools and traditions have identified as the immediate goal of their spiritual endeavours, although it's described in different ways, under different circumstances, and within apparently very different systems of thought and practice. What Sangharakshita speaks of as the transition from effective to real going for refuge is spoken of in other traditions as, for example, stream entry, irreversibility from full and perfect enlightenment, the arising of insight, the opening of the Dharma eye, Satori, the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, or the arising of the bodhicitta. All of these identify a single common experience, an irreversible change in the basic emphasis of one's life from an attraction to the mundane to an attraction to the transcendental. It is a shift from being primarily motivated by karmachanda to being primarily motivated by dhammachanda, and forms the beginning of real spiritual creativity. Sangharakshita's way of resolving all of these different ways of speaking of the goal of spiritual irreversibility into the language of going for refuge has the effect of demonstrating the essential unity of the Buddhist tradition. Once one sees that, much that was previously unclear falls neatly into place. What is more, since all the Buddhist traditions, in principle if not in practice, accept the central significance of the act of going for refuge, Sangharakshita's insight is potentially a major step forward in the establishment of understanding between the different traditions. But one can push his insight still further. We can apply the template of provisional, effective, real and absolute levels not only to the process of going for refuge, but also to all the many different aspects of spiritual life. We can speak of provisional, effective, real and absolute insight, for example, and we can apply the same template to the practice of ethics, meditation, altruism or devotion. In the context of the refuge tree, we can also apply it to the development of faith. In the Triratna Buddhist community, many people first take up the going for refuge and prostration practice in the context of a going for refuge retreat, that is, one of the retreats that form part of the Triratna Buddhist Order's ordination training process. The going for refuge and prostration practice is undertaken only by order members or those who have asked for ordination, and the latter are asked to take it up only when they have been formally introduced to it in the context of a going for refuge retreat. In the context of the Triratna Buddhist community, ordination signifies the transition from provisional to effective going for refuge. The ordination training process is designed to help people make that transition, so many of those who take up the prostration practice do so from the provisional level of going for refuge. Their faith in all the figures on the refuge tree is therefore provisional, not yet ready to fully commit themselves to a life of spiritual endeavour within the context of the order. Their relationship to the refuge tree may be very important to them, but it is not yet the central fact of their lives. People practicing at this level may have very strong feelings of confidence and trust in the figures on the tree, but they will not yet have fully worked out all its implications for their future. At the effective level of faith, once you have fully committed yourself, and in this case joined the order, the refuge tree takes its place firmly in the centre of your life. Whether you do the prostration practice regularly or not, it stands as an effective symbol of that in which you place your faith. You have taken your place in the field of spiritual influence that radiates out from the refuges, and your life is now increasingly dedicated to opening yourself up to that influence and passing it on. You are not yet spiritually irreversible. As conditions change, your faith in the refuges waxes and wanes. But as long as you place yourself in beneficial circumstances, your confidence in the refuges and your heartfelt love of the three jewels will grow ever stronger. At the real level of faith, you have entered fully into the realm of the refuge tree. Your faith in the refuges is unshakable, and the figures on the tree become living presences in your life. At this level, being a member of the Arya Sangha, you yourself become an object of faith for others. You stand for the achievement to which they aspire, and you help them to move forward themselves. At the absolute level, there is no ultimate difference between yourself and the tree. But that is a very long way indeed. The importance of faith in Buddhism should not be underestimated. Knowing the good, Socrates said, was sufficient. If one knew what was good, one would do it. That's all very well for someone of Socrates' level of integrity. For the majority of us, however, the gap between knowing good and doing it is large. As Aristotle pointed out, Socrates' statement does not account for what Aristotle called the irrational parts of the soul. The Buddha was well aware of this fundamental human issue. Indeed, he took it into account in his formulation of the Noble Eightfold Path. The path begins with a moment of perfect vision. We have an intuitive flash of insight into the way things really are. And Shraddha, faith, arises. We see that what the Buddha said was true. We have a moment when we know the truth. But that moment does not last, because we are not yet emotionally ready to absorb the full implications of that knowing and to live out all its implications in our daily lives, we soon lose it. The stage of perfect vision is followed by the stage of perfect emotion. We have to bring our emotional lives into line with the vision. It is not enough simply to know. We also have to feel before we begin to act. The stage of perfect emotion, then, is where we begin to develop the feelings appropriate to our understanding of the Dharma. At this stage, we develop what Sangharakshita has called the emotional equivalence of our intellectual understandings. And we can do this using many different means. We can read devotional poetry and literature, listen to devotional music, and look at devotional pictures. We can engage in acts of puja and offering. Whatever will engage our emotions and our imagination with that which we think of as the highest in our lives. We can also perform the going for refuge and prostration practice. Visualizing the refuge tree in front of us, in all its glowing glory, we create and adorn an image that stands as a luminous representation of all that we hold dear. Reciting verses of devotion and aspiration, we speak out and therefore concretize our heartfelt aspiration to arrange our lives in accordance with our highest values. Throwing ourselves down before the tree again and again, we live out and deepen our feelings of faith and devotion, and we make our relationship to the tree plain to ourselves and others. We have our place at the foot of the tree. That's where we truly belong, below the refuges, looking up. In this and in other ways, acts of faith and devotion are a central part of our living out the provisional or effective levels of going for refuge that we experience in our lives. Engaging with such practices again and again, we make our going for refuge deeper and deeper. In time, we might even make it real. End of chapter.